Labor and Commerce Committee will now come to order. It is 3:18 on Wednesday, March 11th, 2020, in Barnes Room 124. Members present are Representatives Hannon, Gillis, Story, Vice Chair Stutes, and myself. Representative Sponholz, Representatives Rasmussen and Fields are excused. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Take a moment to silence your cell phones if you haven't already done so. Before we begin, I want to thank Sophia Tenney, the House Labor and Commerce Secretary from Records, and Taylor Kelly from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today, as well as Ted Madsen, our trustee committee aide. We will be covering three bills at today's hearing, HB 91 on naturopaths by Representative Johnston, HB 27 on flame retardant chemicals by Representative Tarr, and House Bill 146 on motor vehicle dealers by Representative Klayman. And first up is 91, and in classic labor and commerce efficiency, we want to just move it along here. Ms. Schein, welcome back.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Erin Schein, and I'm staff for Representative Johnston. House Bill 91 before you is a modernization of scope for naturopathic doctors in Alaska. Not only does it modernize their scope, but it also modernizes their statutes for the powers and duties of the Divisions of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing with the CS before you, which is version K.
All right, fantastic. So we received no amendments on this legislation. Are there any other points of discussion any committee members would like to make before we take a motion? Representative Story.
Yeah, I have one question and I have a discussion point I'd like to make.
Pull a little time.
Through the chair, my question is, what evidence do we have, if any, from other states that have expanded the naturopath scope of practice, that has risked public safety?
That's a great question. Through the chair, Representative Story, in my conversations with Washington and Oregon last year, I contacted their regulatory body and their authority, or their Divisions of Corporations, Business, and Professional-like entity, and their rates of any sort of investigation were fairly minimal. Mm-hmm. They didn't have solid data for me, but in the conversations, it was nothing more than any other board that had those investigations.
So what I'm hearing you saying is that there was not any kind of spike in malpractice or things gone wrong that has been noticed in those states, is what you're telling me?
Through the chair, Representative Story, yes, that was the information that I had received from those two states. And if I could, Madam Chair, if I could expand, in both of those states, they do have some limited prescriptive authority of controlled substances. And this bill does not require or does not allow that, but those states, they do have that, and their rates weren't spiking.
Okay. Follow-up?
You follow-up. Yeah, thank you. And it was important to me, and I was looked into doing an amendment with Legal that it is clear that naturopaths need to, behind their name, be a doctor that says they're a naturopath and not a medical doctor, that wouldn't be any confusion, because I think it's really important for any member of the public to know that they were seeing a naturopathic doctor or they're seeing a regular doctor. And I did get a memo from Ledge Legal that is already in our state statute, mm-hmm. that you have to say if you're a neuro, what type of doctor that you mm-hmm. are. You just can't say doctor if you're a naturopathic doctor.
Mm-hmm. All right. And just for the record, there is no such thing as a regular doctor. A regular
yes.
doctor is sometimes what we call allopathic doctors or medical doctors, but there are lots of different kinds of doctors. So.
And follow up to that, they do list all the types of doctors in this memo if you would like to learn all the types of doctors, different doctors. So thank you.
All right. We certainly appreciate your diligence, Representative Story. Are there any other comments on the part of the committee? Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Chair Sponholz. I want to appreciate the work that Ms. Schein has done over the last year. Last year in the committee, when we first started hearing this bill, there was lots of concerns about the pharmaceutical practices, and amendment was done to the bill in the interim to come up with the committee substitute we're working on today that included making sure that anyone who had that had taken the pharmaceutical units and passed a specific test You know, the other element that seems to get a lot of pushback from a broader medical community of allopathic doctors is the term surgery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were some points where it was sort of implied that you're going to have naturopathic doctors doing open heart surgery in their little office. And I was reminded at looking at some medical billings that the last two procedures where I had a skin tag clipped off and a ganglion cyst drained, those were surgeries, even though they were done in the office and, you know, neither really even bled for minutes. So we're not talking about hugely complex procedures that would always imply to fix my compound fractured leg, I'm going to see an orthopedic surgeon. I'm not going to be seeing a naturopathic doctor. And I think that although there is concern, and rightly so, to make sure that anytime we are addressing medical services in Alaska, we want to make sure that we are not putting our citizens at risk. And I believe that the committee substitute for House Bill 91 has enough protections and provisions and will help serve Alaskans in the diversity of medical approaches and needs that we are hearing from our constituents that they want to have in their communities. And so I will be supporting this bill in its form.
All right. Are there any other comments from the committee? All right. Seeing none, I would entertain a motion to move the bill.
Madam Chair, I would be happy to make that motion. Chair Sponholz, I move committee substitute for House Bill 91, Work Order 31-LS0608/K from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? All right. Seeing none, the bill moves from committee, and we're going to take a brief at ease while we sign the report. All right. Next up, we have HB 27 on flame retardants. Ms. Carla Hurt, please proceed forward. Can you introduce yourself for the record and then give us a brief recap of the legislation today?
Thank you. My name is Carla Hurt. I'm staff to Representative Garen Tarr, who will be calling in to round out the testimony. She had another appointment outside the building. I am prepared to briefly go through the bill again if there's desire of the committee, or to just introduce the two handouts that we put on your table.
If you could just give the brief summary of the bill, thanks.
Sure. The House Bill 27 regulates flame retardants, and it is fairly similar to an Anchorage law that was passed last year. Mm-hmm. I can run through a couple of the differences in it. Section 3 of HB 27, Anchorage bans all flame retardants above 1,000 parts per million, mm-hmm. and House Bill 27 bans at all levels. House Bill 27 bans a class of organohalogenated chemicals and antimony. Anchorage goes further by linking with further listings of Washington State and California that have more robust more robust environmental health programs to review things. Alaska statutes aren't drafted with links to other laws, so we won't be doing that. On page 3 under exemptions and definitions, House Bill 27 is also banning toys and electronic products that are primarily used in the home. We removed child seats from the definition of covered items, but the industry is interpreting the bill as if child restraint systems are covered. The civil penalties are slightly different. Alaska State is $500 a day versus Anchorage $300, and for subsequent violations, $1,000 a day versus $300 in Anchorage. We have no enforcement provisions in this bill, so the penalties are really fairly cosmetic. Mm-hmm. We still allow the state DEC to participate in the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse if they desire. We don't appropriate any money for it. Dues for the clearinghouse, if DEC wants to participate, are $2,000 for our state population at this time. Mm-hmm. Anchorage requires some labeling confirmed with California requirements. Again, Alaska doesn't link our requirements to another state, so we don't have any labeling requirement in HB 27. And Anchorage requires retention of records to prove that your products are do not contain the prohibited flame retardants, and we don't require any retention of records. As well, Anchorage has a hardship waiver from compliance with the flame retardant prohibition. We don't have that in our HB 27. in speaking with the person who's the head of the Muni, Anchorage Muni Environmental Health Services, he said they haven't had any inquiries about that waiver, and he didn't anticipate any, but it's new in the enforcement of that law in Anchorage. And that's pretty much the bill.
All right, fantastic. Are there any questions for Ms. Hart? All right. If you could actually email the comparison to us between the Muni and the statute that we're looking at, Ms. Hart, that'd be very helpful. Thank you.
I will do that. Thank you. And Madam Chair, if I could just point out, I have provided you all with a little summary list of a sample postcard. Alaska Community Action on Toxics on Monday provided us with Alaska Community Action on Toxics provided us with a stack of postcards they've been collecting for the past 2 years. We've got these all scanned, and I'll send all the offices a scan. I didn't photocopy all of the copies of this because I'm not sure you really need or want them, but I'll get your offices all a PDF copy.
All right. All right, thank you very much. Are there any questions for Ms. Hart? We're reviewing the document right now, I think.
And
Representative Gillis?
Chair.
All right.
Will this conflict with federal laws about flame retardants on furniture and regular mattresses?
Through the chair, no, Representative Gillis. Right now there are no federal laws on this, which is why the states are acting and why municipalities are acting.
Okay.
Follow up?
No, ma'am.
All right. Talkative as always, Mr. Gillis. All right. All right. With that, then, I think what we'll do is we'll move forward with public testimony. We're going to go ahead and open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify? All right. Seeing none, next up we will go to the off-net, and we have Ben Gann with the American Chemistry Council.
Hi. This is Ben Gann. Should I start?
Please do.
Okay. I'm Ben Gann, with a director at the American Chemistry Council, or ACC, here today representing ACC's North American Flame Retardant Alliance, or NAFRA. NAFRA member companies represent the cutting edge of fire safety chemistry and technology and are dedicated to improving performance in a wide range of products. The industry is also committed to strong chemical safety regulation to protect users and those who may be exposed to its products, while also protecting that same population from the dangers of fire. I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify today. Fire is a public safety threat, and that is no less true in Alaska. In 2018, there were over 2,900 fire incidents in Alaska, causing 89 civilian-related injuries, 11 civilian fire deaths, and over $54 million in property loss. In my limited time, I would like to focus on three issues with the legislation. First, a class-based approach to regulating flame retardants is not consistent with the current state of the science. Not all flame retardants are the same. A variety of flame retardants are necessary because the materials that need to be made fire-resistant are very different in their physical nature and chemical composition, as are the end-use performance requirements of the final product. To that point, the National Academies of Sciences studied 161 organohalogen flame retardants, and in May 2019, released a report that found these chemicals are so different that a single class approach is scientifically inappropriate, since the grouping of chemicals by class glosses over differences in chemical structure, physicochemical properties, and predicted biological effects. Second, HB 27 would remove the possibility for manufacturers and product designers to use new, innovative, and sustainable products in the research and development pipeline that have not yet come to market and could be essential to helping meet fire standards in the future. The approval process for new chemicals globally, including in the U.S., is extremely rigorous. Alaska should not permanently remove the possibility of using new flame retardant technologies that could help save lives and property from fire. Third, flame retardants are reviewed for their safety by regulators around the world. This legislation would ban substances that government regulators have already determined do not present a risk, like a ban that fails to acknowledge science-based regulatory processes and future developments is not good public policy. risks associated with a chemical in a product are dependent upon the structure of the chemical, as well as the magnitude, duration, and frequency of exposure. HB 27 falls short of the scientific standard by presuming that these flame-retardant chemistries cannot, under any circumstances, be safely used in consumer products. In conclusion, the approach outlined in HB 27 runs contrary to sound science, is overly broad, discourages development of innovative new flame retardants to meet product safety standards, ignores safety determinations made by regulatory authorities, and may increase fire safety risk. So, in conclusion, ACC and NAFRA supports strong, transparent, and science-based regulatory approach that provides both strong fire protection and chemical safety. We look forward to continuing to work with the legislature on the issues of fire safety, chemical safety, and product innovation. Thank you for your time and consideration.
All right. Thank you much for your testimony today, Mr. Gann. Are there any questions for Mr. Gann? All right. There are no questions. Moving on to Lauren Aguilar. Ms. Aguilar?
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the House and Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Lauren Aguilar, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Juvenile Products Manufacturers Association. They are a national not-for-profit trade organization that represents 95% of the prenatal to preschool industry, including the producers, importers, and distributors of a broad range of child care items. We wanted to raise some concerns on House Bill 27 that will restrict children's products with flame retardant chemicals. The critical concern that we have with the bill is the continued deviation with the Anchorage City Ordinance that was passed last year. The approach in HB 27 would have negative impacts with internal and inaccessible electronic and electrical components of products as well as car seats. JPMA worked with the City of Anchorage on their ordinance last year, and while not perfect, it is a reasonable approach for juvenile products. We appreciate that the ordinance does exempt child restraint systems or car seats, as well as internal electronic components of juvenile products. If this committee is going to move forward with this bill, we would appreciate it be further amended to be consistent with Anchorage's approach. We also wanted to note some unintended consequences of bans that could cause for car seats and electronics that are used for safety of juveniles. The removal and avoidance of flame retardants is feasible in some circumstances. It is not in others. And if House Bill 27 is passed, there will be a broad ban on life-saving juvenile products that require flame retardants to meet safety and performance standards. Specifically, child restraint systems or car seats are an example of a product where every component must meet stringent flammability standards administered by the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Additionally, electronic components and nursery monitors that help check babies' movement and the respiratory function of newborns and premature babies rely heavily on electronic components that also have to meet these stringent flammability requirements. Even if no flame retardant is used in any other part of the product and the component does not have any exposure to the child, these products would likely be banned under this legislation. Every state that has passed flame retardant restrictions impacting juvenile products have exempted electronic components and child restraint systems, car seats, including Minnesota, Washington, Maine, Vermont, and even the city of San Francisco and Anchorage, Alaska. Product safety is a top priority for JPMA and our members, and we understand and support preventing exposure to these dangerous chemicals. I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss House Bill 27 and our industry's role in ensuring safety for juvenile products. And I respectfully request that the committee consider the negative consequences of the bill in its current form and will consider necessary amendments to make it fully consistent with Anchorage if the bill is to move forward. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions for Ms. Aguilar? All right. Seeing none, thank you for your testimony today. Next up, we've got Pamela Miller.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Pamela Miller, and I represent Alaska Community Action on Toxics, a nonprofit public interest environmental health research and advocacy organization based in Anchorage. First, I would like to thank the Chair and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee for your careful deliberation of HB 27. We have three key messages that we would like to convey in support of passage of this bill. One, toxic flame retardants do not provide proven fire safety benefits, and fire safety standards can be met without them. Flame retardant chemicals make the products more hazardous while in use and more toxic if they do catch fire. flame retardants increase the risk of cancer and other diseases in firefighters because they make fires more toxic, penetrating protective gear and clothing. And we really need to do what we can to protect the health and safety of our firefighters. And this bill has enjoyed the support of diverse organizations, including those representing firefighters as well as the Fire Chiefs Association. We know from science that flame retardants are hazardous to children, especially, and children have higher exposures than adults. These chemicals can cause lifelong harm. These neurodevelopmental and carcinogenic hazards represent immense costs to the healthcare system and suffering to families. These are unnecessary exposures. And to address the gentleman from the American Chemistry Council, I think the science is actually clear that we need a class-based approach. And this was backed up by recommendations from the Consumer Product Safety Commission, who did a call for a class approach of eliminating organohalogens from a set of products. So we think that this is actually a good and precautionary important approach for these product categories, including child care articles, mattresses and mattress pads, upholstered furniture. The chemicals migrate out, leading to widespread human exposure to mixtures of these chemicals. We think that Alaska has an opportunity to lead and build on the foundation of the landmark ordinance in Anchorage passed last March and to protect the health of all Alaskans. Thank you again for your consideration of our views.
Are there any questions for Ms. Miller? All right, Ms. Miller, I have a couple of questions for you. Do you have a preference in terms of approach between the municipalities ordinance and the state? Do you have a strong feeling about whether or not electronic products and child restraint systems should be included or excluded?
Well, I think both of those product categories do represent a hazard to children. I understand what the person from the Juvenile Products Association, Manufacturing Association, is making concerning car seats. However, there are car seats being manufactured today that meet fire safety standards without the use of flame retardant chemicals. And with regard to electronic components, I think there's also strong scientific evidence that these internal components do leach toxic flame retardants into the indoor environment, so they do represent a safety hazard. We worked very closely on the Anchorage Ordinance, and those were compromises that we made with the Anchorage Ordinance. I think if the state could pass a bill that's substantively similar, we would be able to live with that. We would like to see inclusion of three product categories, but certainly understand the need to harmonize with the Anchorage Ordinance, and those would be toys, electronics, and the car restraint systems.
All right, thank you. That's helpful. Any other questions for Ms. Miller? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. Next up, we've got Grant Johnston, or Johnson, I'm sorry.
Good afternoon, Representative Spornholz and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Grant Johnson, and I represent the International Sleep Products Association. The International Sleep Products Association represents companies that manufacture and sell mattresses, and those that provide components and services to mattress companies. On behalf of our members, I'm testifying today to respectfully urge you to vote no on HB 27 or amend it to address flaws that exist with the bill. Among other things, this bill would prohibit the use of antimony trioxide, an important ingredient in some materials used in mattresses that help mattress manufacturers meet federal mattress flammability standards. Specifically, ISPA asks you to vote no or amend HB 27 because banning the use of antimony trioxide limits mattress manufacturers' ability to meet federal flammability standards that are specifically intended to reduce the risk of deadly residential fires. Research has shown that low-income households are especially vulnerable to mattress fires. Additionally, the inclusion of antimony trioxide among the chemicals to be banned by HB 27 is not based on sound science. an exhaustive scientific review conducted by the U.S. Consumer Protection Safety Commission found that the antimony trioxide used in mattresses to meet federal safety standards is safe for the consumer that uses the mattress, the worker that assembles it, and the environment when the mattresses are discarded. All mattresses sold in the United States must comply with flammability standards set and administered by the CPSC that are intended to address ignition risks posed by smoldering cigarettes and open flame heat sources.
Mr. Johnson, could you spell out what the acronyms were?
Sure, I apologize for that. CPSC is the Consumer Protection Safety Commission. They oversee the mattress safety issues federally. These are codified at 16 CFR Part 1632 and 1633 in the Code of Federal Register, and are commonly referred to as Part 1632 and Part 1633 standards, respectively.
It's catchy.
The industry meets the Part 1633 requirements by using a variety of fire barriers made from fabrics and fiber materials that protect the interior materials in mattresses from igniting when exposed to a match, lighter, or candle. The same fabrics and fibers used in our fire barriers have been used safely for decades in a variety of applications, including in firefighting gear, race car driving garments, and building materials. ISPA estimates that approximately 25% of mattresses sold in the United States meet the Consumer Protection Safety Commission's federal flammability standards by using fire barriers that contain antimony trioxide. The fiber made with this chemical is a highly durable, and the antimony trioxide is firmly bound into the polymer matrix of the fiber itself. In addition, when the Consumer Protection Safety Commission promulgated its most recent mattress flammability standard in 2005, it considered whether the chemical posed toxicity risks for humans. That organization found antimony trioxide to be safe for the workers that make the mattress, the consumer that sleeps on it, and the environment when the mattress is worn out and discarded. HB 27 would limit the industry's ability to meet the requirements of Part 1633 by using a material that the relevant federal safety officials have concluded does not expose consumers, workers, or the environment to safety risks. We urge you to vote no on HB 27 because it is an important material using mattresses that is effective in improving residential fire safety and does not pose a toxicity or other health risk to consumers when used in a mattress. Alternatively, ISPA requests that you amend the bill to strike the reference to antimony trioxide and exclude from its scope products that must meet 16 CFR 1633, the open flame mattress standard administered by the Consumer Protection Safety Commission. We look forward to working with the committee, and I appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Johnson? All right. There are no questions. Thank you for your testimony today. Next up, we've got Susan Ingalls.
Hi. Susan Ingalls here. Thank you very much for having me here with you. Thank you for your consideration of this bill. I am calling as Executive Director of Sustainable Furnishings Council, which is an organization of companies involved in residential furnishings in various ways, manufacturers of all kinds of furnishings products, stores where these things are sold, design firms, etc. Our 400 member companies do business throughout North America, including in Alaska. Each of these companies makes a commitment to sustainability, which means different things for different companies. But what consumers look for among these companies, and the reason they look to them, is the company's willingness to be transparent about what they're doing. Well, one thing that many of our member companies are doing is avoiding harmful chemical inputs in the manufacture of their products. And it's not just our member companies. It's also the largest retailers that have voluntarily chosen to eliminate flame retardant chemicals from their furniture products. So among our members and others, there would be Williams Sonoma and Walmart and Costco and Target and Ashley and Lazy Boy and Macy's, et cetera. So these companies do not, and IKEA, I must mention, these companies have a commitment to their customers' safety. And they know that consumers are responsive to toxin-free or less toxic products. Our own consumer research that we've been doing for about 10 years does show this as well. 97% of consumers are concerned that things in their homes are making them sick. So, again, I'm just so pleased that y'all are considering this bill, and I urge you to pass it. These consumers that are concerned are more inclined to choose furniture that they have reason to believe is good for them. They actually think the government is keeping them safe. And that is what you would be doing in passing this bill that would keep them safe from this range of harmful chemicals that are used as flame retardants, they are known to be not consistently effective in that job either. So I'm here to say, please pass the bill. We know that the chemicals are going to leach out of all sorts of products that they are in. Furniture is especially significant because the chemicals leach out in dust, and when we sit on a piece of furniture, dust comes out, and that dust is how we are exposed to these harmful chemicals that are directly related to a range of health problems, including neurodevelopmental effects and endocrine system disruption, various cancers, et cetera. So the manufacturers agree we don't need it. The consumers prefer not to have it. You are in a position to protect your citizens. I hope you will.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today, Ms. Engels. Are there any questions for the testifier? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. All right. And Representative Tarr is on the line. I'm going to close public testimony now and turn to Representative Tarr in the event she would like to make any closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity to weigh in. I know one of the questions that committee members had was related to some of the disproportional health effects for firefighters as a workplace safety issue. And so we did prepare a handout and have passed that out to members just to substantiate some of those issues and show the elevated rates. And really alarming, I believe it was that in 2016, according to the International Firefighters Association, cancer was responsible for 70% of the deaths. So really significant workplace safety issue for those first responders, as well as the potential health impacts for people in the home. So I hope that answers some of those questions. And in response to some of the other testimony, in particular on the issue related to antimony, 75% of mattresses do not use that anymore, and that removal is consistent with the Anchorage ordinance. So that is already, at least for the city of Anchorage, that is already the policy. So if we would adopt it, it would just become the statewide policy. I don't know if there are any other items to address, but I hope that those cover some of those points, and we're very interested in kind of working through any of the issues that committee members may have to feel comfortable with the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Tarr, for providing that additional information. I mean, I think hearing that there are some cancers which firefighters have twice the risk of the population at large is, deeply concerning, and we want to make sure that our firefighters are as healthy as possible. So that was very helpful for me. Thank you. Does anybody else have any questions for Representative Tarr? Representative Story.
Thank you. Yes. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, we had some testimony just a few minutes ago talking about how this legislation differs from the Anchorage legislation. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you were aware of how it differs and your reasons for not including the or including more than what was included in the Anchorage ordinance.
Thank you, Representative Story. And through the chair, I would just echo the comments made by Ms. Miller that there are reasons to be concerned about those products in the flame retardants used in the electronics as well as the car seats. But in looking at where the safe alternatives are and trying to, sort of push where we think the policy needs to go, we have included those so that we can have the conversation and so people are aware of the health risks associated with exposure from those products. We did previously in the Resources Committee substitute make a change that was intended to cover the car seats, but it may need a little better clarity, and so we're okay with that. And then on the electronics, again, there are concerns about those component parts. If it's the will of the committee that at this time, that is a product those are a group of products that we may want to reconsider for inclusion, then, we're willing to definitely have that conversation. But by including them, at least it gives us the opportunity to help educate about some of those health risks.
Thank you.
Any further questions? All right, looks like you've answered all of our questions, Representative Tarr. I appreciate that very much. At this time, we're going to set aside HB 27, and we will take it up in the committee again on Monday for amendments and final action at that time. So next up, we are going to HB 146, an auto dealer's sponsored by Representative Klayman. Welcome, Representative Klayman.
Be here.
All right. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and then begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Klayman, State House Representative for House District 21. Seated with me is David Clark, one of my staff members, and I would like to thank you all for hearing House Bill 146 today. The purpose of House Bill 146 is to improve consumer protections for those purchasing motor vehicles by strengthening requirements for motor vehicle dealers. Under current law, biennial registration is required with an application to the Department of Motor Vehicles, a $50 registration fee, and a $50,000 surety bond. Applicants are not required to furnish a certificate of liability insurance, and there is no requirement to list a telephone number on the initial application. These are lenient requirements compared to other states. For example, Oregon statutes on motor vehicle dealerships provide for the process of applying for and of maintaining an automobile light dealer license, grounds for suspension and revocation of the license, as well as a full definition of illegal practices and associated penalties. Delaware statutes require applicants to provide a proof of location of the business and identify grounds for license revocation. Texas statutes provide for automobile dealer licensure and maintenance processes, as well as detailed procedures for complaints, judicial review, and penalties. Unlike these other states, there are no Alaska statutes providing for a grievance process, grounds for revocation, or proof of location. These lenient requirements are making it easier for rogue applicants to become motor vehicle dealers and put consumer safety and protection at risk. Two scenarios illustrate the need for these changes. When a dealer obtains a license, they are qualified to purchase cars at dealer-only auctions at steep discounts. Curbstoning occurs when the dealer is not required to disclose the fact that they are in fact a licensed car dealer or that the vehicle has a reconstructed title or has known defects. If deemed a personal vehicle, the vehicle is not subject to a routine safety inspection. Often the title is not placed in the dealer's name, the contact information provided is not the dealer's information, or the transaction takes place in cash, leaving little trail for the consumer to follow if issues arise. House Bill 146 seeks to provide better protection when one selling dealer sells multiple vehicles to a buying dealer and receives payment without providing titles to the buying dealer. The titles are in fact being held by the bank that provides a line of credit for purchasing vehicles to the selling dealer. The selling dealer plans to pay for the vehicles and get the titles, but runs into financial difficulties.
Slow down just a little bit, Representative Klayman.
Selling dealer plans to pay for the vehicles and get the titles, but runs into financial difficulties and then is unable to continue making payments. The bank then repossesses the vehicles from the buying dealer. The buying dealer has now lost the money and decides to seek to get recompensed from the selling dealer's bond. At present, the bond requirement under state law is $50,000, which, depending on the type and quantity of vehicles, may be only a fraction of what is actually owed. The purpose of House 146 is to establish a more rigorous application process in the interest of transparency and reducing the potential for harm through increased bond amounts, mandatory liability insurance, and additional disclosures that will hold automobilers more accountable as business owners than under current statutes. And with that, I will turn it over to my staff, David Clark, who will explain the bill in greater detail.
Chair Sponholz and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is David Clark, and I am staff to Representative Matt Klayman. House Bill 146 strengthens automobile consumer protection by requiring potential automobile dealers to follow a strengthened application process. Section 1 of this legislation amends AS 0866030 by requiring the applicant to provide A, a working telephone number for the business listed on the application, B, a written statement affirming that no person holding a 5% or greater interest in the business has been convicted of a felony involving fraud, embezzlement, or misappropriation of property within 5 years preceding the date of the application. C, a statement acknowledging that the applicant has reviewed the requirements for workers' compensation insurance and will maintain workers' compensation insurance if it is applicable. And D, a copy of the liability policy certificate of insurance, further detailed in Section 3 of this bill. Section 2 of this legislation raises the current bond amount required of auto dealer applicants, as outlined in AS 0866060, subparagraph A, from $50,000 to $100,000. Section 3 of this bill adds a new section to AS 0866 that requires that dealers maintain liability insurance of not less than $50,000 for property damage, $100,000 for injury to a single person, and $200,000 for injury to more than one person. Thank you for considering House Bill 146 today. With that, we're happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
All right. Are there any questions for Representative Klayman or Mr. Clark? Representative Story.
Yes. Through the chair, could you tell me about, for having that amount of insurance, what the cost is typically for a business?
We can actually, I believe one of the people that's providing public testimony can provide that information.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, and I had the question both on the bonding and on the insurance requirements. So, anybody else? All right. Looks like you got off easy. Thank you. We have a few folks ready to testify in the room. I believe that we have Steve Allwine.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Allwine. I am the Alaska Director for the National Auto Dealers Association. I am a member of the Board of Directors for the Alaska Auto Dealers Association, and I'm an automobile retailer, new car retailer here in Juneau. So that sort of takes it all down to the base. And for the record, I am not a doctor.
Are you a naturopath?
Madam Chair, we as dealers, you might wonder why on earth we would want to further regulate ourselves. The reasoning for this is has come about over the last number of years where we've encountered situations, a lot of it based on the internet, a lot of it based on Craigslist, where there are basically bad actors. It's easy to obtain a dealer license in the state of Alaska, much more so than in any other state, frankly. And the costs are nominal. And because of that, you can go out and get a license. You have access to these closed auctions, and these are dealer-only auctions. And in a lot of cases, they deal with dealers swapping cars between inventories. Maybe they can't sell it, or maybe it's something they don't want to mess with if it requires a significant repair. so they'll run these cars through the auctions. The insurance companies, in a number of cases, if it's a total loss car, will sell it through the auction to a body shop, and the body shops will use them as parts. Ultimately, what happens is if you have a dealer's license, you have access to these types of auctions and these opportunities to buy these vehicles. The rub comes when, as Representative Klayman stated, the rub comes when, as you start out holding yourself out as a dealer, you make this purchase, and then through Craigslist or some other form, you sell the vehicle to a consumer, and they are unaware that you're a dealer. And all of the safeguards that you are afforded as a consumer disappear, because as a consumer, you have no idea that the person you're dealing with is a dealer and has a dealer's license and is a merchant, okay? So that's sort of our motivation in this. The issue that had come up concerning the expense of the bond, my bond at $50,000, and it renews every 2 years, is basically $700. It is, as it turns out, I did some research on this because, frankly, we were advocating some higher numbers. And ultimately, it's a very linear premium. So if it goes from $50,000 to $100,000, it's gone from $700 to about $1,500. So it is not a barrier to entry, nor did we want it to be for anybody who would like to get into this industry. We would encourage that. But what we do expect is that if you're going to get in our business, you need to behave as a business in a responsible manner. So having said that, I would be happy to answer any questions, and I would frankly urge your support of this legislation. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Alwine? All right. We don't have any questions for you right now. Actually, I have one question. You said it was $700 for 2 years?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Next up, we're going to go to Troy Jarvis on the phone.
Yes. Through the chair, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak. As the president of the Las Auto Dealers, I just want to show my support for this and let you know that I've been in the car business in Alaska for almost 40 years, and it's gotten really bad in the last several years with people being misled and deception by wholesalers. There are dealers that are not representing themselves as dealers. I have several friends and several customers that have been in the dealership that have been misled and bought vehicles that were salvaged, that needed major mechanical repairs, that weren't disclosed, the engines were partially, you know, we call it putting lipstick on a pig to make it look pretty, but inside it's not pretty and it's not going to last. And they know that when they sell the cars to these people. So there's been a lot of consumers hurt by this, and we look at this as a Consumer Protection Act. As Steve said, you know, as dealers, we're not trying to make it more difficult for us to get licenses, but we do want to regulate ourselves. And as the president of Las Auto Dealers, we have been given a lot of leniency to protect and correct each other's actions to make sure that we monitor each other's to give car dealers a good name in Alaska. And this law is so laxative and lenient to enable people to get licensed that for very little money and very little risk and very little investment, they don't have brick and mortar, they don't have rent, they don't have any other expenses, and then they compound the problem by not disclosing that they're dealers and put their cars on Craigslist and represent themselves as being a private party, that their mother died and was her little old lady went to church on Sunday days and Sundays and the car was never blah, 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 and you understand where I'm going with that. So we just want to make it legitimate, we want to make it safe, and we want to protect our consumers so that we don't get lumped together with, you know, giving car dealers a worse reputation than some of them already have. So I do ask you for your support on this, and be happy to open to any questions anybody has.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Jarvis? So I guess nobody else has a question, so I'm going to jump in here. I just want to – I'm going to paraphrase what I thought I heard earlier in Mr. Alwine's description, that there are people who are – who are registered as dealers, who are potentially buying cars through auctions that are not up to par and then are selling them through Craigslist, sort of posing as, you know, individual citizens and selling lemons or poorly maintained or damaged cars to people without transparently revealing that they actually can be held responsible for selling a bad car. Is that a fair statement? Could you correct any errors in what I just said?
That is correct.
All right. Thank you. That's very helpful. Any other questions? All right. Thank you much for your testimony today. It looks like next up we have Marcus Whaler. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, go ahead and identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Through the chair, my name is Marcus Whaler. I'm a member of the Alaska Automotive Dealers Association, the board member, and I'm an independent dealer here in Anchorage, Alaska. I think, everything that's been said hits the key points in this. I did want to share a little story about a woman who traded a vehicle into me a little over a month ago now, but it kind of exemplifies the problems that we're trying to address in the dealer marketplace. What essentially happened is I had an 80-plus-year-old woman come into my dealership to trade in her 2006 Subaru Tribeca. And when I look at a vehicle at the auction, I use the VIN number and it stores in my phone, so I have a record of it. Well, it just so happened that the vehicle she was trading in was a vehicle I had looked at the auction, and I make notes on my phone as to what the issues are with these cars to best discern their values. And a couple of the items I had was there was an airbag light on and there was a check engine light on. And when she came to trade it in, I looked at it. I ended up selling her one of our vehicles, and she traded that vehicle in. And when I took that vehicle, when I interviewed her, I asked her where she had purchased that, and she had told me she bought it from a private party off of Craigslist, which I thought was interesting because it had been at the auction, 8 weeks ago. And so when I took that vehicle in trade, and I took it over to my shop to have a mechanical inspection on the vehicle, the mechanic reported back to me that the check engine light bulb had been removed and that the airbag wires had been cut, so there was no airbag light on. So that completely rendered the airbag safety system inoperable. So, just a perfect example of what had happened. This woman thought she was buying a vehicle from a private party off of Craigslist. Actually, she was buying it from a dealer. He had, removed some of the safety features from the vehicle. He had removed the check engine light, so there was no way that she could have known the problems that the vehicle had, and totally misrepresented himself as a private party. And this is just happening again and again and again in our marketplace. And, this is a 80-plus-year-old woman. And I get so many people coming in, trading vehicles back in, who have no idea the parties that they've dealt with. And, everything from reconstructed titles to situations such as this. So this is what we're trying to address by bringing some standards to bear upon our industry. Hopefully, this is going to benefit the consumer and also dealers ultimately in our reputations. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Whaler? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today. And all right, next up, it looks like I think that's the end of our testifiers today. We do also have Joanne Olson, who's with the Division of Motor Vehicles, in case anybody has any questions for the department. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Olson, has the Division of Motor Vehicles seen this increase in fraudulent behavior by dealers acting as individual parties and reselling to private parties vehicles that are used and have reconstructed titles? Is that something that you noticed statistically or through paperwork escalating the last 5 years? Or was it the industry that was able to identify this problem and bring it to your attention?
Through the chair, Joanne Olson, Interim Director with the Division of Motor Vehicles. I've worked for the division for over 31 years, and through my experience, yes, I have experienced such behavior, and I am also aware that not having a phone number is a problem, because when the customer comes in that does purchase from dealers that are not upfront honest, we have no way to contact them. Increasing the bond might help, because the cost of vehicles have gone up in price. And I hope I answered your question.
You did. Thank you.
Is Mr. Whaler still on the line?
Yes, I am.
I guess there was something about your description of this story that caught my attention. I'm trying to sort of needle it down, and I'm wondering, you know, in terms of the remedy that's being proposed in the bill, there's an increase in bonding required. There's a requirement that you know, essentially nobody can have a license if they've been convicted of a felony, and then there's the phone number. And you believe that these are the remedies that would prevent this from happening again?
So it's not a panacea by any stretch of the imagination. We do hope it'll curb some of these behaviors. Mm-hmm. You know, it's obviously when you have people that are lawless, it's not going to have a tremendous impact on that group. But by bringing some type of standards to bear to our industry, I went through a lot of the states that were mentioned earlier and looked at their dealer licensing requirements. And there's nothing in the country that even comes close to the lack of standards that we suffer here in Alaska. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, this is just a minimum introduction without trying to, you know, put other people out of business or trying to hurt, you know, people who are doing reputable selling out there without storefronts. But we do think it'll curb these behaviors. But as far as like eradicating them completely, no, I don't believe it'll do that, but it will have an impact.
Is there a requirement that people who are registered dealers, you know, post that information whenever there's a sale transaction taking place?
As far as I know, you are supposed to represent yourself as a dealer when you do sell, when you're in a selling transaction. But again, we're kind of a grievance-driven you know, situation. So when a problem arises, it's usually, you know, it's something that's brought to the attention of the Attorney General. So it's a very difficult thing to track, particularly when you don't have phone numbers. They didn't even know in the beginning that they were dealing with a dealer. They thought it was a private party. And usually, you know, if you feel like you've been involved with a private party transaction, there isn't a lot of recourse. Their tendency, I believe, is not to go to the Attorney General or somebody else. But if you're dealing with a business, obviously they'd be more inclined to pursue that through, you know, all methods, all avenues that they had available. As far as I know, though, it is a requirement to disclose that, but it's not happening.
So in the case of the 80-year-old woman who brought in the Subaru Tribeca, then did you file a report? Did she file a report? Or is this just a story that you're sharing with us?
So it was a little difficult to track down because the title had already been transferred into her name. She did not remember the name of the party who she had dealt with, only that it was a private party and that she had found the car on Craigslist while shopping. And then I was able to connect the dots based on, you know, what she had told me.
And you're pretty comfortable that she was acting in good faith?
Oh, I'm 100% comfortable, yes. I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of about $4,500 that she lost over a period of 60 days.
due to the mistake she had made and the misrepresentations from this other dealer.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is Ms. Olson still on the line?
Through the chair, yes, I am.
You know, as we're just thinking about what are the sort of protections that could be put in place to, you know, ensure that unscrupulous dealers aren't misrepresenting themselves, it would be helpful for me if, you know, you could share with the committee, like, what, if any, enforcement is undertaken right now, and if you had any additional recommendations as to what it is that we should do in terms of transparency or enforcement that, you know, the legislature could offer that would help to solve the problem.
Through the chair, this is a start. This will help. I don't have any suggestions at this time as to how they could improve it even better, but looking at the bill, I think what they put in will deter some of those people that are not honest, like I said previously, from applying for a license, especially if they have the requirement that they cannot have been convicted within the last 5 years. That would be a help. But I have come across a lot of vehicles that was described in the situation by the previous gentleman. Mm-hmm. And there's not much we could do in trying to protect the public from it.
When you identify that somebody has been a victim of this kind of fraud or deception, what does the DMV do?
There's not much that we can do because the person already put the title into their name. I personally have come across where dealers have folded this closed shop, and there is not much we can do. We don't get the title. The customer will go in, pay for the vehicle to the dealership. The dealership closes up, does not pay the loan off for the vehicles they have on their lot, and the finance company is stuck holding the bag because there's no cars for them to take. It's been given to the customer who bought the vehicle. Now, the customer who bought the vehicle can't obtain title because they don't have the ownership. They don't have the title because the finance company is holding the title. In that situation, they have to file a 3-year non-cancelable bond for 1.5 times the value, and the value is determined by a bonding company. They go in and decide how much the vehicle is worth, and so they have to put up 1.5 times the value of the bond.
Okay. Representative Clayman, do you have something you wanted to add?
One, in terms of consumer remedies, the auto dealers are subject to the consumer protection and the Deceptive Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act, which is a state act, and so if they were found liable on a civil claim, they would be subject to treble damages. That's been existing law for quite a while. And so that exists, and it does apply to car dealers. The other feature, which hasn't gotten a lot of discussion, but one of the key features of the bill is adding required liability insurance. Mm-hmm. The situation that they describe with the Subaru Tribeca, the insurance company, interestingly, might claim that there's no coverage because it appears that the person that sold it to her was taking intentional acts to disable safety devices, and so mm-hmm. the insurance company might say, well, we cover negligence, but we don't cover intentional acts. But if you didn't have evidence of intentional acts and somebody sold a car that had problems with it, having the insurance requirement would actually provide a source of money should somebody come bring a claim against the dealer, and that's a new addition. And the other part that the liability insurance adds to consumer protection is literally many of us that own cars, if we go and drive a test car, our coverage that we have on our existing car will actually mm-hmm. provide us with coverage for the test driving right. car. But if you actually don't own a car and don't have insurance and you're getting ready to buy, say, your first car and you go down to the dealer and you drive a car, well, the dealer may not have insurance for you, but this insurance requirement would make it so that the person test driving a car has coverage, and if they hit a person in another car or a pedestrian, that would provide coverage for the circumstances when the buyer, potential buyer, is driving the car on the dealer's lot. So there's some significant consumer protections that are added by the insurance requirement that right now there's no requirement to have that insurance.
Okay, that is helpful, but we still have the problem that people are sort of deceptively, you know, presenting themselves as something other than they are, and there doesn't appear to be a very meaningful accountability mechanism, which seems very problematic from a consumer, you know, protection standpoint.
Madam Chair, you are correct that that's one of the challenges, but part of the challenge is that DMV, which would be the agency that might most might potentially have the easiest ability to monitor this, actually we have not put the kind of resources into DMV to give them that kind of investigation capacity to do these kinds of searches, and given our current budget environment. In fact, in working on this bill, there were some specific areas that we made some changes, recognizing that DMV simply lacks a certain amount of operational capacity, and to start having them getting more involved in investigating auto dealers, they don't have the investigators, they don't have the resources today.
Well, it may be that they don't have the investigators and the personnel to do the work, but if I remember correctly, DMV is one of the few agencies in the state of Alaska that actually generates a profit. And so it actually makes money for the state of Alaska, which is wonderful. And if we have, you know, potentially a responsibility to ensure that we're protecting consumers, and the DMV has, you know, the resources, has the financial resources but not the FTE to solve the problem, maybe that's, you know, part of a remedy. And I understand that that would add a fiscal note to your bill, which is a little bit of a challenge, but I mean, I think, you know, there is in fact money at DMV. It's just that we are using those funds for something else rather than for investing in consumer protection. So. All right, not a question, just a comment. All right, any other questions for Representative Klayman? All right, with that, we're gonna go ahead and set this bill aside today. Thanks to everybody who came and testified. So there's gonna be an amendment deadline of Tuesday at 5 p.m. on this piece of legislation, and we'll take it up again next week. So in wrap up, we have a full week next week in House Labor and Commerce. On Monday, we're going to consider Senate Bill 52. We're going to finish up the sectional analysis. We'll take some invited and public testimony, and then set it aside. We'll take action on Senate Bill 52 on Wednesday. The amendment deadline for Senate Bill 52 is Tuesday at 5 p.m. We're going to take up HB 27, the flame retardants bill, which we took public testimony on today. We're going to consider amendments and look to the will of the committee. The amendment deadline for is Monday at noon. And we will, if we have time, we'll take up confirmations. We're going to begin pushing through confirmations in Labor and Commerce next week. Our committee aide, Ted Madsen, will be in touch on that topic. On Wednesday, we're going to take up four bills. We're going to take up HB 257, Financial Institutions, by Representative Laban. That'll be an initial presentation, and we'll have some invited testimony. We'll take up Senate Bill 195 on insurance companies by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, pending referral. We'll have an initial hearing and take invited testimony, and then we'll pick it up again on Friday. Amendments will be due for that bill on Thursday at 5 p.m. We'll pick up 146 by Representative Klayman. Amendments, as I mentioned earlier, are due on Tuesday at 5 p.m. We will look to make to the will of the committee on Wednesday. Then 52, as I mentioned, the Title IV rewrite, will consider amendments and look to the will of the committee. We will also take up confirmations at that hearing. We're going to do confirmations on both Wednesday and Friday next week. We're going to extend into the evening. So we will take a brief break at 5 p.m. So everybody can get a snack on Wednesday and then again on Friday. So we'll take a brief break at 5 p.m. so people can get snack and, you know, take care of biology, and then we'll come back in to begin confirmation hearings. And then on Friday, we will take up Senate Bill 195, look to the will of the committee. Amendment deadline for that will be 5 p.m. on Thursday. And then we're going to take up HB 94, Representative Hannon's vaping products excise tax bill. It'll be up for public testimony, consideration of amendments, and we'll look to the will of the committee. Amendment deadlines for that will also be 5 p.m. on Thursday, and then we'll do, as I mentioned earlier, confirmations also on Friday. It is 4:30 p.m. and this hearing of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is now adjourned early on Friday.